At this point, we're moving forward with our plans for drilling because we have not been told otherwise.
Shell proceeds with its Arctic drilling plans despite mixed messages from the Obama administration. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 30th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Bethel's new alcohol status 6 months later.
Instead of seeing one bottle of R&R, you have cases in the houses. So there is a lot more alcohol available. However, it's not creating problems for law enforcement.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Tech Alaska, working to permit the Red Dog Mine so it can produce for Alaska for another 20 years. Details at reddogalaska.com.
With the oil spill disaster still unfolding in the Gulf of Mexico, the Obama administration has not said clearly whether Shell's planned exploration drilling can go forward in the Arctic Ocean this summer. On Good Morning America today, senior White House advisor David Axelrod said no additional drilling has been authorized until an investigation uncovers why the Deep Horizon oil rig failed. The Interior Department also said today it's beginning a review of offshore drilling safety and technology issues. A spokeswoman for the department says it's waiting for that study to be completed in 30 days before making any decision on Arctic drilling. Shell spokesman Curtis Smith says in the meantime, the company is proceeding as if it can move forward.
We have to put the blueprints in place well in advance to have a safe, responsible program. So that actually started several months ago. If we were to stop or interrupt that activity, it would certainly jeopardize the 2010 season, no matter what came from the White House. So we're going to continue to plan for drilling in 2010 unless we hear otherwise.
Shell says it will be in much shallower water in the Arctic than BP's Gulf of Mexico drilling. The company also says it will bring extensive oil spill response equipment to the Arctic, but that hasn't reassured environmental groups. Margaret Williams is with the World Wildlife Fund in Anchorage. She says cleaning up oil in the Arctic is much more difficult than in warmer waters. She's calling on the Obama administration to put a stop to Shell's summer drilling.
And over again, we in Alaska, we've faced some terrible situations with the Exxon Valdez, and now we're seeing a very similar scenario unfold in the Gulf of Mexico. And if we don't learn from this mistake and we don't apply those lessons to the Arctic, we could be here in a few years talking about the Beaufort and the Chukchi Sea in the same way.
But Alaska's U.S. senators and state officials don't think the BP disaster should derail Shell's plans. A spokesman for Senator Lisa Murkowski stressed that Shell's work can be done safely and says the exploration work is important for the future of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Governor Sean Parnell is also confident the exploration work can go forward. Joe Balash is a special assistant to the governor.
The Parnell administration still fully supports the development of exploration and hopefully ultimately production of oil and gas from the Arctic OCS. The commitment to protecting Alaska's environment has always been a priority and will remain so.
Balash says because of the Exxon Valdez disaster, Alaskans have special expertise in preventing oil spills and responding to them effectively when they do happen. On Tuesday, Bethel voters will again head to the polls to address alcohol in a special election. This time, voters will be asked if the city should go back to damp, the status the city had for more than 30 years before it was revoked in the October election. So what's happened in the last 6 months since local option was dropped? KYUK Shane Iverson says it depends on where you live.
A month after the October vote, several state restrictions were erased. Customer orders are no longer tracked in a statewide database, and airline passengers no longer have to put potentially embarrassing alcohol labels on their packages. Bethel resident Dave Trantham says that fairness has been restored.
Certainly none of us want to be second-class citizens. We want no more than other Alaskans. We want to be treated exactly the same.
Bethel's new status also means there are no limits on the amount of alcohol that can be imported. Some were expecting a wave of crime in Bethel to follow after the vote, but according to Bethel's police chief, that never happened. But Chief Larry Ellerton says his officers have noticed a difference in how people are drinking.
There's less people as far as drunk in public type issues. They're not hanging around AC as much. They're not finding them on the road as much. However, when they go to the houses, there are larger parties, and instead of seeing one bottle of R&R, you have cases in the houses. So there is a lot more alcohol available. However, it's not creating problems for law enforcement.
Many at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation Hospital in Bethel were also expecting a flood in their emergency room. Dr. Matthew Greenberg says that never manifested, but he says his staff has seen more kids coming through.
Anecdotally, what we have seen is that the number of minors, those under the age of 18, that are coming in intoxicated has gone up. That we have some documentation of.
And Greenberg says the amount of alcohol-related incidents has also ticked up.
Assaults, ATV accidents, snowgo accidents, people just falling, tripping, you know, twisting their ankle. And when you ask them, were you drinking at the time? The answer is yes.
Greenberg says the hospital only recently began tracking alcohol-related incidents, so no stats are currently available for comparison. But the Alaska State Troopers do have stats to look back on. They respond to felony cases throughout the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Lieutenant David Tracy looked at felony crimes for the same time periods over the last 3 years.
There wasn't a whole lot of change with the state trooper cases. If anything, that's gone down a little bit.
But Tracy points out that it's the village police safety officers that deal with misdemeanor crimes, which includes domestic violence assaults. And he says the VPSOs have had a noticeable increase in their caseload, such as the situation in Quinnahock, located 80 miles to the southwest of Bethel.
We can see that there's more alcohol coming in.
Wasley Pleasant is the VPSO in Quinnahock.
We see more people drinking. We have more crimes committed, like break-ins, more people running around at night.
Pleasant is also a board member for the Lower Kuskokwim School District. He says the effects of the increased drinking are taking a toll on the children there.
We have kids that come to school that are tired. Seems like they haven't had enough rest.
LKSD Superintendent Gary Baldwin says that's typical of what he's been hearing from his principals in 23 villages.
Pretty much all of our site administrators, in fact, they all agree. We actually asked them at a site administrator meeting a while back if it had had an impact on their students' lives, and they all say that they've had much more problems with student behavior and ability to focus on academics since the election last fall.
Baldwin says that students themselves are confirming that alcohol abuse is up in their homes.
The students often tell us that things aren't good at home and give us specific examples of how it is. You know, we've always heard some of that, but not to the degree that we're hearing it now.
Adding to the disparity between Bethel and surrounding villages is the fact that there are still no alcohol sales in Bethel. Though several businesses applied for a license, the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board turned them all down, and no applications have been sent in since. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Arizona's new law making it a state crime to be an undocumented immigrant has produced nationwide rallies. Tomorrow, that response will include Anchorage. From noon to 2 p.m., several Anchorage groups are sponsoring a cornerside rally for immigration reform at Benson Avenue and the New Seward Highway. Senior Minister Paul Bowling of the First Christian Church, Disciples of Christ, is a backer of tomorrow's events. He wants the rally to promote public awareness that our representatives in Washington need to start actively looking for some sort of solution to the immigration question.
From my perspective, I think our government representatives have been avoiding this issue because it's a very complicated one and people are very passionate about it on all sides of the issue. And I think it's been greatly neglected.
Besides congressional action, Bowling also hopes the rally fosters increased awareness of the difficulties many immigrants face as they try to make a new home in Anchorage and America.
Most of us that have been born here into the United States, have no idea of the problems immigrants face. the legal issues that they come up against, and especially the financial issues. Many of them are here fleeing extreme poverty.
Bowling says his interest in immigration reform began when he was in seminary and became concerned about the impact of the federal government's inaction upon immigrant families. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new book on Aleuts and the sea.
These guys consider their lifestyle to be traditional. They consider it to have deep roots. They've always been oriented towards the ocean.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
The leaders of regional economic development commissions, including Alaska's Denali Commission, gave testimony yesterday to a transportation subcommittee on their proposed 2011 budgets. The Denali Commission has seen a profound decrease in annual funding. Subcommittee Chairwoman Eleanor Holmes Norton asked Denali Commission Co-Chair Joel Niemeyer how the commission is able to operate within a budget that has gone from a peak of more than $140 million in 2006 to $15.9 million for 2011. Niemeyer says they're asking members of their five advisory councils for advice on how to start winding down their programs and what that means.
Because the way I look at it is the federal government invested almost $1 billion over the course of 12 years for the commission to develop very significant relationships, very significant working relationships with a number of partners. So I think that the commission continues to add value based upon those relationships that have been built.
He said other agencies and organizations that the Denali Commission has teamed up with are stepping forward to keep programs going. Chairwoman Holmes Norton said there's concern about how the commission's administrative structure was initially set up. She asked Niemeyer if he thought the Denali Commission would benefit from using a management structure more closely aligned with other regional commissions. Niemeyer says the act establishing the commission has created some administrative problems that need addressing. And although he says using a system that replicates the other commissions has value, he cautioned that there are some vast differences that must be acknowledged.
I do need to note that we don't have counties. We have 200 tribes, and the structure of the other commissions are set up in a different manner. And so if we go through the process of trying to look like the other commissions, which we are supportive of that, we do have to take note that we don't lose that voice, that tribal voice. The significant amount of our work is done in tribal areas, and so we'd want to make sure that they have that opportunity to participate in the process.
Other regional economic development commissions are multi-state agencies, as opposed to the Denali Commission that is exclusive to Alaska. The combined 2011 federal budget proposed for all the commissions is just over $106 million. At a meeting in King Cove, representatives from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service took public comment on the proposed road from King Cove to Cold Bay. The project requires a swap of state and tribal land for a federal easement to establish the single-lane gravel road through the Eisenbeck Wildlife Refuge. From King Cove, KSDP's Kels Hetherington reports.
In King Cove on Thursday, more than 200 residents turned out to offer their support for the road, claiming that they have no dependable access to an all-weather runway in Cold Bay. King Cove Fire Chief Chris Babcock described the many difficulties and close calls met evacuating patients from King Cove. Babcock explained King Cove is served by a treacherous airport and mountainous terrain, often plagued by high winds that earlier this week appear to have been the cause of a Pan Air flight's crash landing. Donna Walker recounted her personal experience being stranded in King Cove after giving birth. When finally she reached medical attention in Anchorage, it was too late, and her daughter's lungs had suffered permanent damage. Marvin Mack and Warren Wilson underscored the need for public land to benefit the public. Wilson also described the economic need for the road to provide access to the state's third longest runway in Cold Bay. Kels Hetherington reporting in King Cove.
10 years of anthropological research in King Cove and the nearby communities has resulted in a new book on the intertwining of Aleut identity and commercial fishing in the Eastern Aleutians and the Alaska Peninsula. KUCB's Ann Hillman has the story.
According to Idaho State University anthropology professor Catherine Reedy Masher, for Aleuts from the far eastern Aleutians and the Alaska Peninsula to be Aleuts, they must be connected to the Aleutians and to the food resources of the region.
It's important that people maintain a connection to those villages to be Aleut. It doesn't mean you have to live there necessarily, but you have to have, the villages have to be in existence and they have to be supplying you with food, and you have to have a home to return to. And the villages themselves have to be viable.
Which in rural Alaska can be difficult. King Cove, False Pass, and the surrounding communities are completely dependent on fishing. Commercial fishing feeds the economy and supports the governments through fish taxes. It's also inextricably intertwined with subsistence fishing, another necessary element of Aleut culture.
The way that they do subsistence is so intertwined with commercial fishing. It's done on the same boats, it's done with the same crew, the same gear, the same waters. They might, you know, set their nets and run up on the beach and go collect bidarkies or go hunt birds or do other things. And it's all intertwined. And they take fish from their commercial nets for subsistence.
Masher argues that this relationship between commercial and subsistence fishing is part of Aleut tradition.
These guys consider their lifestyle to be traditional. They consider it to have deep roots. They've always been oriented towards the ocean. They haven't always been commercial fishing, but they've always been trading products from the sea. They've always been using things from the sea. And this is kind of the modern equivalent of those practices.
So when fishermen from Western Alaska tried to close Area M, the commercial salmon fishing zone that brings money into King Cove and other communities, they could have effectively closed down the Aleut villages and their Aleut culture. Fishermen from Bristol Bay and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta were concerned that the salmon weren't returning to their rivers because they were caught in Area M first.
My job then became to really put a human face on that fishery and show its importance to the communities and how their culture and their identity are really wrapped around those fisheries, and to show its value to the state, and that it's not, once you close that fishery down, you're closing down villages, and that would have a devastating effect on an entire culture.
Masher's new book, Aleut Identities, Tradition and Modernity in an Indigenous Fishery, highlights the struggle to protect the communities from a fishery closure and shows how fishery management policies, such as limited entry permits, can change the structure and health of a community by giving some individuals access to resources, but limiting others. Likewise, crab rationalization changed the fishing fleet size and caused local support industries to close in those villages.
These villages dry up. Then what? Then we have, more people living in Anchorage, more people that have been disenfranchised from their own culture and their own life. And that's tragic, and it shouldn't happen.
Masher argues that fisheries management doesn't just affect the health of a fish stock, but also the health of a culture. Her book, Aleut Identities, is available starting May 1st. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Find qualified Alaskans to fill your company's job vacancies at Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. Alexis has hundreds of workers for you to browse through, and you can specify details about required levels of experience and other qualifications. Learn more at alexsys.alaska.gov or visit any Alaska job center. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Monday marks the next step in the U.S. Census count. On May 3rd, some 1,300 enumerators throughout Alaska will start going to housing units that did not respond to the mailed questionnaires. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Michael Burns, deputy director of the Seattle Regional Census Center, notes that while Alaska's far-flung remote communities have always challenged U.S. census takers, 2010 is presenting a new counting difficulty.
I think the biggest difference from the last 10 years is the immigration that's coming into the state of Alaska. Some of these people coming from different countries are coming from countries where the government was in a harassing mode to its citizenry. They come over to this country, and as soon as you say you're from the U.S. government, there is that fear factor that comes over them.
Burns spoke at a special census non-response follow-up press conference held yesterday at the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage. In rural villages, the Census Bureau hires enumerators from the community. That reduces mistrust, normally solves the language problem, and increases returns. Census takers seek very limited information. Burns says anyone going beyond simple questions about the household should be regarded with suspicion. Burns also stressed that all information is confidential. That's true whether someone is a U.S. citizen or not. Nor is one's personal information shared with any other government agency. Confidentiality is simply the law.
Each of our census takers, like myself, have taken an oath of confidentiality. We cannot divulge any information that we collect on anyone through this census and for the rest of our life.
Burns says as of April 26th, Alaska had a 61% response rate, the lowest in the nation, and well below Wisconsin, the highest with 80% and the national average of 72%. Juneau and Anchorage have about 70% mail response, Fairbanks 60%. The Bureau is working hard to reach 100%. After all, this official population tally carries a sizable financial impact.
When you think of the census, think of it as that underpinning, that actual device to provide needed funds that come back to us for the services that we take for granted.
The Census Bureau estimates that every Alaskan counted means $10,000 in annual federal funding or $120,000 total until the 2020 census count. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
High school hockey players from the Russian Old Believer villages east of Homer will finally be able to lace up their skates for the Homer Mariners next season. A new ruling from the Alaska School Activities Association will, for the first time, permit some small schools to team up with bigger schools for team sports. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has more.
Although the new rules apply to small schools statewide, the fight to get them passed started 25 miles out East End Road in the Russian Old Believer communities of Voznesenka, Razdolna, and Ketchumak Selo. Kids from the village schools, many of whom grew up playing hockey on youth teams with the Homer Hockey Association, were forced to make a difficult decision when they reached ninth grade, either leave the village to enroll at Homer High or give up competitive hockey at the high school level. That all changed Monday when the ASA Board of Directors ruled unanimously at their spring meeting in Nanilchik that schools with student populations under 451 can form co-ops for team sports. Kim Duggar, a local hockey mom who has been waging a campaign with school officials, the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District, and ASA for over 2 years, was ecstatic.
I'm just emotionally overjoyed. It's beyond belief.
The way the amendment was written, says Duggar, allayed the fears of some board members that schools would use a change in the rules to create all-star teams with an unfair competitive advantage.
It doesn't interfere with the big Anchorage schools and just the other situations. It has criteria such that it won't be messy and cause unfairness factors that they were always worried about in granting the waiver.
ASA board member and Nanilchik school principal Terry Martin says the board felt a collective sense of relief after the amendment passed and even burst into a spontaneous round of applause when it became official.
You know, something that we wanted, we just had to figure out the way to get there. It was the right thing to do for students, but we had to, you know, just check it through because oftentimes there are unintended consequences, and so as a board, you don't want to enact something that you have to quickly reverse yourself on.
The ruling will affect small schools across the state, not just Homer High, and covers all team sports, including hockey, football, basketball, softball, and soccer, but not individual sports like wrestling or Nordic skiing. Martin says his school, which does not have the enrollment to field many teams, may now be able to offer new opportunities to students.
We've already got Skyview is already interested in talking with our students about football, you know, because we have about 60 students in our high school, and their numbers are considerably down.
Homer High hockey head coach Buck Lakaitis might stand to gain the most from the new rule. Since their first season 3 years ago, the Mariners have struggled mightily in the North Star Conference, attempting to compete against powerhouses like Wasilla and Palmer, while only being able to dress 14 or 15 players. He says that while his team might improve by adding a handful of Russian players next year, the important thing is keeping kids in school.
So I think, you know, the bottom line is this is going to help graduation rates and a lot of other, you know, positive things. It's bigger than just, you know, having a competitive hockey team.
In Homer, I'm Aaron Selvig.
The Alaska Airmen's Association 2010 State Aviation Trade Show starts tomorrow in Anchorage. The annual event features more than 275 aviation-only exhibits targeting the latest technology, products, and new innovations in the world of flying. Dee Hansen is executive director of the Airmen's Association.
Our mission is to promote general aviation, which is the private aircraft owner here, but the show has sort of evolved into an all-aviation show. We have everything here from light sport aircraft all the way to a really good military aircraft display this year.
There will be live presentations, too. Hansen says Alaska is the flyingest state in the country, with more pilots and aircraft per capita than anywhere else in the nation. The State Aviation Trade Show is free and open to the public. Hansen says families are encouraged to attend.
We've got the Challenger Learning Center here that have hands-on workshops for kids, like on rocketry, and they're going to be doing a couple of different programs on how astronauts survive in space.
The air show runs through Sunday. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Len Anderson and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Kels Hetherington in King Cove, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
GrantStation, your fast track to funding on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. And by
the University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu.
The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.